of our regularly scheduled Monday night shiur, not the first shiur, neither the second one. Our regularly scheduled program calls for Shmuel Bet at 8 o'clock and Maseches Brachos in Yerushalmi at 9 o'clock. But I considered that leading into the Yomim Tovim season, the Tshuva season, that it would behoove us to analyze for the Tanakh hour some different sources that will help us in our Tshuva aspirations. And to that end, the first week we'll be discussing Tehillim. And then we'll see that the rest of the time are part of the liturgies leading into mostly the Haftorahs of the Yomim Noroim season. That will include Hosea, he's the Haftorah of Shabbat Shuvah. Yirmiyahu, he's the Haftorah of the first day of Rosh Hashanah. We will also do Yoel, that's also part of the Haftorah of Shabbat Shuvah. And I stuck that in there because most people don't know anything about Yoel, but he has a very powerful message of Tshuva. And the last one will be Yonah. I mean, how could you do 5 weeks without Yonah at this time of year? So those are our five models of Tshuva. Tehillim, Hosea, Yoel, Yonah, Yirmiyahu. Not exactly in that order, but the order will actually fit most of the Haftorahs. But I start with Tehillim simply because most people think of Tshuva, they don't turn to Tehillim. But before we do anything, I just want you to see what these five or six pages are all about. The first two pages, it says, Amiras Tehillim Bishas Sakana. When you say Tehillim at a time of grave danger, someone is sick. I remember when the first two buildings were hit on 10 years ago, I was giving a class at YU, and everyone at YU thought we were next. Because the tallest building in New York City is, in terms of the height, is the science building at YU. It goes higher than the top of the World Trade Center. So if you just travel in a straight line from the top of the World Trade Center, you are not at the top of that science building. Because Washington Heights is way higher up. There are higher points in Washington Heights, even, but they're not buildings. Anyway, so we thought we were next. So we did was all the students streamed out of the buildings, and we took some Prokim of Tehillim, much like what we said last night between Mincha and Maariv. And we said, Tehillim, Shas Sakona, when you're in danger, what do you say? We don't take out Yirmiyahu, we take out Tehillim. Right? So this is our grave time of need. And I often point to the nature of this need is like the oxymoron of the famous Kol Nidre appeal that every shul makes on the night of Yom Kippur. Why is that an oxymoron? Because first you say, I pledge $1,000, and then right afterwards you say, all the pledges I made this past year are null and void. So what is that all about? At least you should do the appeal after Kol Nidre. Right? So we cite the Gemara in Maseches Chulin to just lead into this. It was the Gemara learns a pasuk in Kohelet that says, "Better not to make nedarim than to make them and not keep them." That's obvious. That's a pasuk in Kohelet. Says Rabbi Meir in the Gemara, "Better not to make nedarim than to make them and keep them." Right? It's obvious that it's better not to make nedarim than to make them and not keep them. But it's even better not to make nedarim than to make them and keep them. Don't make nedarim. So the Gemara asks, this is the Gemara in the beginning of Maseches Chulin, the Gemara asks, wait a second, didn't Yaakov make a neder in Parshas Vayetze? Vayidur Yaakov neder lemor? And we're not familiar with any Gemara that says that was a sin, that was an avera, that Yaakov better don't make nedarim. So the Gemara answers, Yaakov was different. Why? Because he was in the Sakon. He was running for his life from Esav. B'shas Sakona Shani. When it comes to a time of Sakona, you can make Nidarim. So the question is, whose Sakona, whose danger are we talking about at the night of Yom Kippur? Because when Yaakov made his Neder, he wasn't making it because someone else needed that Neder. He was making it to God. God does not need our Neder. God does not need us to say, I'm going to go to Shul every day for the next month because I want this person is sick and I want to say to him. That's my need, right? Yaakov was in need. We're in need. We need to make a neder. because the halacha is, this is not an appeal right here, but the halacha is that when you make a neder and you say, I pledge $1,000, guess what? That counts as if though you gave it.
Oh.
It's going to be worse afterwards if you don't, but it counts because there's something in the Gemara. Amira l'gvoa k'misira l'hedyot. And by the way, that's the law in this land also. If someone publicly hears you say, I'm going to give $1,000 a year for 10 years, and you stop giving after 3 years, they can take you to court. Okay? So it's true in the halacha also. You make the pledge, even in your heart. Right? And it's as if though you was a true but feel it stuck on my Venus Rose, you gave that stock already. Even though you didn't write the check out. It's the opposite, you don't want to write it out. So this is the sakana we're talking about. I am in need. But what happens when I say Tehillim? So here, the first page here warns us to avoid thinking that saying Tehillim itself is helpful. There's no such thing. To think that when I say Tehillim, the words of Tehillim will help me, that's wrong-headed, certainly according to the Rambam, who, if you, let's just take a look at source number 4 for a moment. Right? Mishenoshcho akrav. You see it? Source number 4? If a scorpion bites you, a nachash, a snake, mutar l'chosh al makom anashicha v'apilu b'shavas kedei liyashiv datu l'chazek libo. So he says you're allowed to look at it and say, oh, you know, say something, say anything you want over it, some kind of enchantment, anything you want, you can say under a whisper to make it yourself feel better. Alpha pishayin adav amoil klum. Even though this doesn't help, since he's in danger and his life is in danger, if he thinks that saying something over this dangerous thing will help him, then it's okay. That's also why the Rambam allows carrying a kmiya baduk on Shabbos in the Mishus Rabbim. You carry an amulet that someone else carried, and the Gemara in Masechet Shabbos talks about. Remember what Rashi says was a common amulet in France in the Middle Ages? A rabbit's foot. That you carry it around and you feel it gives you luck, you can carry it on Shabbos in a public domain. If the person is a second. Imagine that. The Rambam knows that doesn't really help, but he thinks it helps. The Rambam was aware of the power of the suggestion. Right? Next. Haloche shal hamaka v'kori pasuk min ha-Torah v'chein ha-kori al-atinok shelo yivas. But if you're not in grave danger, that your life is not in danger, and you're just saying psukim so that a baby should go to sleep, or you put tefillin near the baby so that the baby should be comfortable, it's not enough that they're engaging in witchcraft. They are rejecting Torah. They're kofir. They're turning the words of Torah into personal benefit when it's for physical benefit, when it's supposed to be for spiritual benefit. The Rambam says the same in the next halacha about putting extra psukim in mezuzahs. Right? Take a look and turn the page. Where, if you say Tehillim on a regular basis, almost every Tehillim that you buy that says, that says to say it in the Shas Takana, we'll have this Yehi Ratzon on it. You see at the top of the page? Yehi Ratzon v'nachash v'nokem v'kenes v'abokher b'dovet avdo. You see it? This tefillah says, may the words that I'm saying, may the psukim that I'm saying in Tehillim go out into the Shemayim and circle me and protect me. This is what you find in the Siddur. So Rav Moshe Sternbach in the Tshuva copied down this nusach of saying Tehillim. Someone asked him, is this appropriate to say? And he said, an interesting answer. I know it's in all of the Sfarim. Look in any Tehillim Sefer and you'll find it. I'm sure it's in that Tehillim Sefer. This Yehi Ratzon. It's in all the Tehillim Sfarim. It's in the art scroll. I took this from an art scroll sitter. Right? So he said, there are certainly Siddurim that have it. You have it there?
Yeah.
Okay. And he says, the Rambam would be against it. He said, it seems to be that it would be against the Rambam. Why are people saying it? I don't know. But here's the point, and that's what I want, this is my introduction. When we say Tehillim, it's crucial to understand what we're doing, and perhaps even more crucial to understand what we're not doing. We are not trying to guarantee success for whatever reason I'm saying this. Israel should have peace. my relative should be well, this person having an operation should have a successful procedure, etc., etc., etc. No one should make the mistake of thinking that my Tehillim is meant to guarantee the successful outcome. And that's a good question unto its own. When I do tshuva, what in my mind indicates that my tshuva was successful? I got the job I'm looking for? Finally she said, yes, she will go out with me. You know what I'm saying? My mother will get better. That lottery that I keep buying once a week will finally work its way to me. You know what I'm saying? What would make you feel that your tshuva was successful?
Well, yes? Rambam says that if you come to the same situation and are able to not...
It's not a function of what happens afterwards. Don't look at it, that's as irrational. I'm giving an example over the last few days as going into a store, fill your shopping cart with groceries, and when it comes time to pay at the counter, you say, "Oh, I wore tefillin today. I'm going out with these things. I'm not paying for this. I paid. I did a mitzvah." So don't look at the success of tshuva in terms of, so what good things is God doing for me because I was there for him. The success of tshuva is simply, did I do that thing again that I said I wouldn't do? Then you succeeded in tshuva. Now let the kavod come. Now let the reward come. All right, but it's unrealistic to think that the success of my tshuva, the success of my Rosh Hashanah or Yom Kippur, has to be weighed against what happens to me right afterwards. Right? That'll come by itself. Let's hope that, you know, let's look forward to that. So here is what I'm starting off saying that Tehillim is not. Tehillim is not hana'as atzmo. It's not just okay, let these words go out and win that lottery for me. It's not that. However, what it is hopefully, since it touches upon such a wide array of elements of our lives, that we hope that we are changed as a result of saying this Tehillim. It would help to probably more meaningful to say it in English, right? Just to stop say psukim, but we don't know what we're saying and rushing through it because we promised every day I'd say at 12 o'clock, between 12 and 12:30, I'd say two prakim or something, or you know, and just to rush through my perek or two. It's really much more important that we know what we're saying. Take a short perek, learn it in English, and say it and know what we're saying is will mean more. How am I changed? That's how Tehillim can have an effect. I've become a different person. Okay, because I'm a different person, then next time my mother calls upon me for this, I will be there for her. Things will, she'll get better, or whatever it might be. I'm going to be a better person as a result of saying Tehillim, as a result of my tshuva, and let's see how that changes things. Listen, Sefer Koheles has psukim like, you know, sometimes as a result of doing tshuva, so you left the base medrash, and you left the minion, and a brick falls in the top of the building and crashes you in the head. Goodbye. It's like the boy who does the two mitzvahs guaranteeing long life, and he falls off the ladder and he dies. Those things will happen, because that's, you know, the world is for now, at least certainly without the hashkacha pratis of the time of the Beis Hamikdash and the Nevi'im, these things will happen. But we just have to try our best. Okay, that's the introduction. What Tehillim is and what it's not. Okay. So now I've chosen, and much of what I gave you here is to take home and to read. You may recall that some of this was the topic of my Shabbos Shuvah Drasha a few years ago, in comparing the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. No joke here. Very important tshuva, moving away from alcoholism. It's one of the most difficult tshuvas of all of mankind. Some say it's harder than doing tshuva from gambling, harder than doing tshuva from lust. What makes alcoholism so much more difficult than everything else? Because the alcohol itself harms the part of your brain that helps you make the decisions, should I do this or should I do this? The other things, yes, the role of the dice also, but that's just what you're used to, but it doesn't. Studies show that when a gambler sees a roll of dice, something happens in his head that's similar to someone who just took a shot of drugs or something, right? But the alcoholism, as they say, is the worst, and so Alcoholics Anonymous really has a good foothold on some of this. I would just say, if you just to what I did was I gave you the 12 steps and exacts what appears to be exact parallel psukim in Sefer Tehillim to those 12 steps. It's uncanny. Whoever was writing this had Tehillim in mind. You see it? I gave it there, and it's like page 4 or 5. You see it? There's one profound difference I would like to point out between Tehillim and Alcoholics Anonymous, and then I'll get to the four prakim I wanted to learn with you. And I think the function of this difference is that Alcoholics Anonymous has more of a Christian influence than a Jewish influence, even though it certainly has a biblical influence, right? Which would mean that they take a lot from Tehillim. Tehillim is Tehillim. But there is one. Can you think, if you know enough about the Inyan, a profound difference between a Christian approach to someone who's hopelessly dependent on alcoholism and a Jewish approach?
Well, I'm just looking through this here, but it says we're entirely ready to have God remove all the defects of character, and we don't really believe that God is solely
exactly precisely. 100% precisely, is that Alcoholics Anonymous teaches that the person who has gone so far and dug himself so deep into alcohol dependency has no way out except through Psalms and God and these efforts. Judaism does not teach that. Judaism does not believe that we need to. I mean, they say it's sin. Oh God. The Son of God. You know, they say you have to put your faith into this, and then you'll make it. You don't believe in that. You believe that the path to our salvation is in our own free will and in our own choice. Some of those choices are made more difficult by circumstance. Amnon's free will not to take his sister. You know what story I'm talking about, right? I mentioned it so many times. Amnon, who fell in love with his sister, slated to be the next king of Israel. Right? The reader knows that if he takes his sister, he's never going to be king. So what makes him choose to take his sister? Because he was used to getting whatever he wants. Right? Your free choice is much harder to work with if you're used to getting whatever you want. Right? You feel it? So Amnon was not empowered, if you will, to make the right choice in that story. No more than I, you know, if I may digress, then maybe Kobe Bryant was the night that he almost destroyed his whole career for one night with a stranger. What made him choose that? Because he's used to getting whatever he wants for years now. And plus, he might have also known that even if I do get into trouble, I could buy myself out with a $30 million lawyer. Or a French monetary man can do the same. Or all these people who make stupid decisions that ruin their lives. And these are not stupid people, right? Stupid is as stupid does, but they say. But the point is that sometimes your free will is removed from you because of circumstance. So Judaism is teaching the alcoholic that you can't stray so far. It's your free will. Again, maybe many impediments to that. Christianity says it's you're nowhere without that faith in God or the Son of God, whatever you want to call it. But Judaism says that it's more within your power. So yes, exactly. Okay, so let's look at these are two, basically two introductions. Is what Tehillim is, what are we saying, and these 12 steps. By all means, please take these sheets. I made them up for you to take. Look at these 12 steps. And you know, there's one other thing I gave you here. Is it says that all 12 steps are now written on one page in larger print, juxtaposed to the 20 steps of the Orchos Tzaddikim. According to some traditionalists, the Orchos Tzaddikim is the Rosh. He seems to be a student of the Ramban, in the very least. He never identifies, divulges his name. It's a very popular source right now. It's been translated. So the Orchos Tzaddikim gives 20 steps to tshuva. We've always thought that there were 4 steps to tshuva, right? What are they? Recognizing the sin. confessing the sin, feeling bad about the sin, and doing it again, taking it upon ourselves that we won't do it again. Right? So we say we have to be in a similar situation, right? In the future, this is the Chachma of Yosef, who wanted to put his brothers in a similar situation of having the possibility of leaving a favorite son of Yaakov behind. He really ran them through the mill over this, and maybe went a little too far. If he just wanted to determine that they felt bad for what they had done, he knew that as soon as Reuven rebuked them in the very beginning of the story, I told you you shouldn't sin with the lad. It's very clear that they had, after 20 years, they were still thinking about Yosef. But Yosef, this is the Ramban and the Barbanel, wanted to put them in a very similar position. And this time, they could say, oh, you know, we would like to take Binyamin home, but who told him to steal that cup? They might have a good reason, but they have to be in a similar position to do full tshuva. That's the Ramban.
As a side note, if they did complete tshuva, then why is it still considered to be a black mark on the Jewish
nation? So my view of how Bereishis goes is because for all of the reconciliation between the brothers, it seems that Yosef never forgave them. How do you know that they felt that? As soon as Yaakov died, they said, Lu yistamenu Yosef. It's been 17 years, for goodness sakes, they've been together with Yaakov alive. So for 17 years, it bore on their head that after Tati dies, he may want to kill us. Imagine such a thing? And they went over to him and said, our father told us to tell you that you shouldn't kill us for selling you. Bogus! First of all, Yaakov never knew they sold him. Even if he knew they sold him, he probably wouldn't think that Yosef would take vengeance like that. And if Yaakov knew Yosef sold him and thought he would take vengeance, finish my sentence, wouldn't it make sense for him to go Yosef directly and tell him not to kill them, than to go? So the Gemara Yevama says it's one of the lies of Mutu Lashanos Mitan Shalom. Yes, Dan?
Also, didn't some Yosef tell him one time that
so it seems from that that, you know, it was part of God's plan, but I still, you know, he never, it doesn't seem that he ever you know, Yosef seems to be quite magnanimous throughout the end of the story there, but it seems that, and that's
that God could have done or orchestrated the events in a different way.
Yeah, of course, right. That's according to the Rav, why we read about Asara Hugi Malchus on Yom Kippur, not just Tisha B'Av. Tisha B'Av for sadness, Yom Kippur for kapara. Mm-hmm. Right. So I mean, look, I think we might have touched upon this in one form or another. But you know, when David in the beginning of Malachim Aleph, remember they brought in Avishak HaShunamis to warm him. So it says, "VeHamelach lo yida'ah." They weren't intimate. So she wanted to be married to him. So he says, "No, I already have 18 wives." But that's not. The Radak says something else. The Radak says that David had to atone for an earlier time in his life when he took someone he shouldn't have, by now not taking someone that he could have. Right? The Raivad discusses this. He could have, whatever. I'll leave it at that. But the Gemara in Sanhedrin has her with a quick wit, where she says to him, "The ganav is too old to steal," and he blames him on his tshuva. You could look at the Gemara there in the second parak in Sanhedrin. She says, "This is not complete tshuva, my king, because you're a little older now." At which time he whatever, but
that's
I ain't Shaman the Gemara, please. Yeah, the Gemara is the Gemara. I would Chas v'Shalom never say something like this without being a Gemara.
That's the Rome's concept. If your desire is waned, then you can never do complete tshuva.
Yeah. So that's, you better do tshuva when it's still on the front burner. Okay. Anyway, so that is the so you have the 20 steps of the Orchos Tzadikim, together with where I considered, you can look it up, please. You see the boxes next to the 20 steps of the Orchos Tzadikim? That's where I feel that his 20 steps are similar to the 12 steps of the Alcoholics Anonymous. All right? Okay, there's really quite a bit to learn from these things. Now let's look up our prophet. Okay? First parak I'd like to do is chapter 51. You have it there in the Hebrew and the English. Right? Right, so I mean, I'd like to really, you have it in both. It's really a great parak to say in both languages around Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur time. It says, "L'Netzach Mizmor LaDavid," and you see what where it's moving right away. "B'voi Lov Noson HaNovi Kasher Bo Bashala." This is what David thought and said when Natan came to rebuke him for taking Bathsheba. The rebuke came in the form of David rebuking himself. Right. He gave him a parable, right? And he said, "Who that man should die? He's such a cruel man to take the right." If the parable, I assume everybody here knows the parable, right? If the parable were exact, the rich man should have not only taken the poor man's sheep, he should have
sent him
to death afterwards. At that point, David would say, "Come on, this is not a true story. Look at a rich man takes a poor man's only sheep and then kills him for it, right?" He goes, "Well, you just did that." Right, so David says, "Chai Hashem ki ben moves ha'ish hazos." Such cruelty. And then he says, "And let him pay fourfold for the sheep." He shows knowledge of Parshas Mishpatim on that. But since when is stealing a sheep punishable with death, except in the Old West? Right? What kind of halacha is this? Right? So the Gemara says, "David, it's more in Yuma. You're so quick to pronounce the death penalty for this? You will lose four sheep. The baby, Avshalom, Amnon. The fourth, in one source, is Adoniyahu, but Adoniyahu lived, died after David. So the fourth, according to another source, is Tamar, who according to one medrash committed suicide after with her brother did her, when she didn't get satisfaction of his prosecution. Right? So he lost four children in his lifetime. Right, so I think when you teach or when you learn Shmuel Bet and you learn the story of David and Bathsheba, you have to learn this perek right after Perek Yud Aleph and Yud Beis of Shmuel Beis.
Doesn't the Gemara say David HaMelech lo chata that he?
Well, when the Gemara says Kol Omer David chata eino ela toeh, right? That's a Gemara in Shabbos and Ksuvos. So. First of all, I didn't give you the Tshuvas Chachmei Pravant. I had made it up, but then I decided it was too long. This Rav, the Amora, looked at this where it says Rebbe is saying this because he's descended from David. It's clear, forget about the story of David and Bathsheba. The stories afterwards show that he's punished for the rest of his life. Something is obviously wrong, whether it's Lo Tachmod, maybe you can say that he was over in Morad B'Malchus, she wasn't really a married woman. We can look through all those Makaros, and there's plenty in Shas to talk about this.
Is there any one that brings down the fact that because he did such complete tshuva that his sins were wiped away?
That's what this parak is about.
So maybe that's what it means.
That's the Gemara in Yuma that says that David's sins were monumental compared to the tiny sins of Shaul. Shaul was a much better specimen of humanity, says the Gemara. Look it up. Dachav Beis than David. So why is David's kingdom lasting al me'ad? Because Hashem does not look at the sin, he looks at the heart, the tshuva. Shaul's small sins remain a blotch on him because he doesn't know how to do tshuva. Precisely because he was so perfect. The perfect man cannot picture himself doing anything wrong. Mishich Mavamala is not a blotch on him. So precisely because David is so much more imperfect than Shaul, he's capable of saying chatasi. So let's see what he has here, and we'll see through this perek what might be the worst part of the whole Bathsheba story. Where, at what point does it say Vayera Hadavar Be'enei Hashem? This thing was evil in the eyes of God. What was it about the story that was so contemptuous?
Isn't it better to be more perfect and as opposed to being constantly imperfect and doing tshuva? I mean, perfection is also part of discretion and judgment.
So there's a Medrash Tanchuma that asks about comparing Yosef and Yehuda. Yosef is the perfect from nature, and Yehuda is the one who struggles, and you know, the king comes from Yehuda. This is a Greek question also. The Greek philosophers asked it also, But and Judaism seems to side with, the Rambam does, that it's better to be the struggler, the one who has to struggle to reach that position. You know, we can take the argument further, but that Yosef and Yehuda compared this way, Shaul and David compared this way, and we can probably find a few others. But I just wanted to answer the question is what bothered Hashem the most was the cover up. I think Richard Nixon knows that, and Bill Clinton knows that, and people, you know, it's one thing come clean, but you have to weigh coming clean with the possibility that maybe they will never find out, right? And so that's the hope that they'll never find out. So it's at some point, you know, it's just all right. You got to come clean now because they're going to find out, right? Today in today's time, when they you know they're going to find out, so you come clean before it hits the newspapers, and then when it hits the newspapers, you say, well, I said that guy came clean already, right? Okay, yeah. All right. So this parak is about David's response to such a thing, and he says, "Choneni Elokim kechasdecha kirov hachamecha mecheip sha'ai." That's the first thing he asks: erase my sin. Can that ever be done? He's asking for it. So the Gemara in Sanhedrin says that David's ultimate, remember, Shkios miyovin mistakeni gamizidim chasochav dechaz mipesh v'nikesi mipesharav. Will you give me ultimate redemption? Which is what? What will be the ultimate redemption? Take the story out of Tanakh. Don't let it be. Why do they have to read about it? So Hashem says, no, I can't. But he did, Stanley, take it out of Divrei Yomim. Correct. The story of Bathsheba is not in Divrei Yomim. Divrei Yomim, Malchei Yehuda, it's very favorable to the kings of Yehuda, and they took it out. But Hashem said, no, I want to have it in Shmuel Bet. I want the people to read so that they can see what you went through, and they can see that in this country, the king is not above the law. In other countries, even to this day, someone comes and accuses the king, Atoha Ish, that man is dead. Right? Even if, you know, I must confess, I did see the movie David and Bathsheba, just for artistic purposes. So in the movie, when Gregory Peck is trying to wheedle his way out of what he did, he said, oh, what a misfortune that I happen to be the king of Israel, because if I was the king of any other country, I wouldn't have any problem with this. How do you like that? Okay? So he says, Herev kapseini me'avoni u'mechatosi tahareini. I'm asking you for help, God. Now, isn't this a little Christian? Why is he asking God for help? So he's saying, look, I've done all I can. I'm doing what I know what I need to do, but I need some help from you, not from me to reach the stage I need to reach. I can do. The human being has to be able to do that on his own. So here, it was dependent on maybe some Gemaras, Bava Metzia and others that say that the people mocked him. That he was getting, people would ask him, so what's the punishment for Boral Ish Ish? But I don't know what to do with those Agadatas, because it's mashma, at least I think so, that the cover-up was so pervasive that the masses did not know about Bathsheba. I don't think so. I think that if Avshalom had known about Bathsheba, if Adoniyahu had known about how Shlomo was born, that would have been the centerpiece of their rebellion. Not that I'll be a better judge than David. That was the centerpiece of Avshalom's rebellion. You'll get more justice from me than my father. The centerpiece would have been for Adoniyahu, who crowned himself king against Shlomo, it would have been, you don't want to be ruled by a man who's a product of... Right. So the answer is when Hashem told David, when Nosson told David, Gam Hashem he'evir escha toscha lo tamus, God has uplifted your guilt, you shall not die, implies that you ought to die for this. The king of Israel gets malchus for wearing shatnas like any other Jew. Right? So there was no edim, we don't have due course, we don't have due process. So I'm going to let you slide on this. All right? But you'll spend the rest of your life in Shmuel Bet dodging two bullets. One, you destroy the man's home, your home is going to be destroyed from within. Can you do better than a son who tries to kill you? Another son who violates a daughter, right? Another son who tries to take over the kingdom?
Right? So is he punished, though, for counting the people? That's another
sin later, but at the end of Shmuel Bet. But and then there's And because he used the sword of Ammon to do it, the sword would chase him for the rest of his life. Sometimes in the form of Sheva ben Bichri, sometimes in the form of Shimon ben Gera, sometimes in the form of Avshalom, sometimes in the form of still the Plishtim or some of it. So that is the okay. So he says, listen, keep Sha'ay ani Eda v'chatasi negdi tamid. I know my iniquity, and my sin is with me at all times. This scarlet leather cites this pasuk, the book, that she had to have this sin with her at all times. This is the pasuk. Go back and read it, and you'll find it. Chatosi negdi tamid. L'chol avad chachatosi. How can you explain pasuk vav? To you alone I have sinned? What do you mean? I have not sinned to Uriah? I have not sinned to Right, Bathsheba may have come out ahead on this one. There's an interesting thing, and the movie touches upon this. Did Bathsheba and Uriah have a good marriage?
We don't know.
Do we know? The movie says it was a terrible marriage. No, but is there any indication in the story that it wasn't a good marriage? I'm sorry that the Rebbetzin is here, it's not fair. But if I've been away at war for 6 months, and the king tells me to go home, I don't care how principled I am. I'm going home. I did not go home. He's a very principled man. One has to be amazed at how principled Uriah is. Right? How does he not go home? Right? He sleeps in the street because he's... I can go a lot of different directions of this. But for goodness sakes, you've been called from the... When he was called on to home to... report on the battle, that it would not seem unusual to him. Uriah's name is listed amongst the 37 top generals of David at the end of Shmuel Bet. Okay? He was on the Stratego board, a 2 or a 3. on the old Stratego. Now the new Stratego is different, I think. The higher you go, is better.
Yeah.
So he's a general, he's a colonel or something. So she wouldn't think it's unusual to be called, or what are you calling a corporal to come back and tell you about the battle? Right? So, all right, good, he's there, you're home already, so go to your wife. So, but I would like to explain, the Mefarshim say that when David says, Chatasi, only you know, I've sinned only to you, because only you know. In other words, I have to hide this. Sometimes, you know, we don't have a confessional. Ki imcha haslicha lama'an tivorei. So when he says, L'cho levat cho chatasi, he doesn't mean that my sin, and we know we're talking about Bathsheba here, because the heading. You know, we're not talking about any other sin right here, but when he says L'chol avat chachatasi v'horabe einecha asisi l'man titztak b'davrecha tizkeh b'shoftecha, he's saying, God, I understand that you're letting me live, and it's crucial. I have some unfinished business to take care of so that my son can build this temple you promised me, right? David, it seems, might have felt that I don't deserve that promise anymore, right? In fact, I found one parish that says when he finally realized that he would still be able to have his son build the Beis HaMikdash, that Hashem, that he sang Mizmor Shir Chanukah Sabayis LeDavid, because he felt that he was very gratified. I won't build it, but my son will. That's okay. Man is never jealous of his son. So Hashem said, your tshuva was so perfect, and you turned yourself around, and you suffered so much for this. Not only will your son build the Beis HaMikdash, but her son will. Her son. This woman's son. Bathsheba's son. Right? Okay. Hein ba'avon chololti uvechet yechemasni imi. More Christian stuff here. What does David mean when he says, I was formed in sin, and my mother like warmed me or bore me in sin? What does that mean? Okay. So one, there's one way to approach this is to talk about Yishai himself, right? I've shared that word with you a number of occasions, right? About David's birth, that his father thought he was a mamzer, right? So the Radak on this pasuk talks about Christian theology and original sin, and the virgin birth. It was a very clever position to use a pasuk in Yeshayahu to show that we're hopelessly sinful and we're going to wallow away in our sin for the rest of eternity unless we profess belief in the only one not created that way with the necessary sin of his parents. So forget about the fact that the proof text they bring from Isaiah 7:14 is so far off grammatically, syntactically. He talks about a woman who's already pregnant. she the word alma philologically does not mean a basula, it means a virgin, it means a young maiden, right? And the whole point is that this child who's going to be born from this young maiden is going to save you now from the Assyrians. He didn't live at the time of the Assyrians, and he didn't save us from the Romans either. This child is supposed to say, who is this child? It was the Medet king's son, Chizkiyahu, who did save us from the Assyrians, right? But I have a separate problem. What kind of altruistic God puts a man right smack in the middle of human history so that from his time and on, we can profess belief in him and save ourselves from the evils of purgatory because of our parents' indiscretion? That's an egregious philosophy. Do you know Christianity teaches that everyone unfortunate enough to have been born before him has been waiting in purgatory?
What about
ask a Catholic priest about that.
Alright,
so before that, man got around with seven mitzvahs, the same way. I believe that a righteous Gentile has the same salvation for seven mitzvahs. That's his soul. His soul just needs seven, mine needs 613. Alright? Okay, let's continue. So what does this mean? So the Radak says, very simply, for all desires of man, it's true the Rambam says that there are two that are the highest of all, higher than alcohol, higher than gambling, is money and lust. Those are the two. I was thinking of putting it on my Dvar Torah last Shabbos, that would you believe this? Rabbi Yisrael Salanter said, there's a din of yichud. You should not be yichud, a woman with a man who's not her husband or her brother or her father or her son, right? A man with a woman who's not her, right? So we know that, that's called yichud. So he said also, you should never have yichud with someone else's money. Never be in the same room, just you and someone else's money that's unguarded. And he was serious, it's not a joke. So if money and lust is way up there, the Radak says lust is higher than money. Why? Kitiv'i. Tiv'i. That's how we were created. So it's within us. So we lust after it. So okay. So hein b'avon chalalti. It's the cause of more sin than anything else. But be kedusha over tahara. The Rambam wrote in the Mor Nevuchim that the human need to touch, to shake hands, to hug, to embrace friends and people who are married. The need for that is shameful. The Rambam said. You ever read this? Where did he get that from?
Aristotle,
of course, it's Aristotelian. It says the human need for touch, you should be like, Simon and Garfunkel on Iraq, and I have my books, my poetry, and that's all you need. I'm shielded in my armor. Right, should I continue? Hiding in my room, safe within my womb. I touch no one, and no one touches me. Right? So that's the Rambam's ideal. Amazing. Ramban thought it was such a misguided approach that the Ramban wrote a whole book about this called Igeres HaKodesh. Get it? Igeres HaKodesh. About human touch and intimacy. So he says, Hein Babon Cholalti, you know what, the circumstance of my birth, and you know what, in L'David Hashem Ori, which I see I'm not getting to tonight, this always happens, but in the L'David Hashem Ori, He says, Ki avi v'imi azavuni, Hashem ya'asfeini. You ever see what Rashi writes on that? Hold on to your seats because it'll knock you off. I'm just quoting exactly Rashi. Rashi says, B'shas tashmish avi v'imi lahana asam niskavnu. When I was conceived, my parents were only thinking of their own hana'a. They weren't thinking of giving to the other. They were just thinking of their own pleasure, their own benefit. So, hein ba'avon cholalti. If you're not thinking of a giving moment, then it's just what's that for? You're being selfish, and selfish is a sin. Selfishness is a sin. So that's what he writes this. Okay, la'ayin sham in the Radak, please. Hein emes chafatz da batucha usuba sasum chokma todieni. I'm going to skip over that pasuk. Tichateni be'ezov ve'etar tichabseni u'meshela galbin. Help me, God. We have things that help people get to be tahor physically. Like paraduma, that's why he uses the word ezov here, right? We have a mikveh, so I will physically wash myself and I prepare myself for tahara, right? So, you see, let's skip to Yudalef. Haster panecha mechata'oi b'chol avonusai mechei. You know, the Rambam seems to contradict himself between two halachos. In one halacha, the Rambam says, you have to confess your sin and then take it upon yourself to move on. In another halacha, he says, look to the future and get yourself on firm ground, and then you look back and you try to fix what you did. Create the situation again, maybe. Right? So why did the Rambam mix it up and say 1, 2, 3, 4, and then 1, 3, 2, 4? So I saw in Rav Moshe Sternbach, who points this out in Hilchos Tshuva, he says that it depends on the sin. Some sins are so egregious, and this is certainly one of them. This is about the most egregious thing that any king does in Tanakh, outside of hardcore Avodah Zarah. I mean, it involves a lot of the big, you know, it starts off with Lo Tachmod, right? He I'm not saying there was anything wrong with him actually looking and seeing her that day. He should have just quickly walked away, right? I've said it so many times with a powerful Gemara in Sukkah. Remember what I'm saying? In the parable, he says, there were two men in your kingdom, one rich with a lot of sheep, one poor with just one sheep. The rich man had a Halech who came by his house. All this is all one Pasuk, a big long Pasuk Dalet. The rich man had a Halech that came to his house. He refused to take any of his own sheep to give to the guest who came to him. Instead, he took the one sole sheep of the poor man, La'ish Haba'elov. First the Halech comes to his house, then he's an Oreach, and then he's an Ish. The rich man is David, the poor man is Uriah, the sheep is Bathsheba, the many sheep of the rich man are the wives of David. Who is the guest?
Desire.
The Yitzhar, the thing that makes the rich man want to take the poor man's sheep. The desire starts off being called a Halech, just passes by. David wasn't looking for her. He was walking on his patio, which is a permitted thing. She might have been doing something wrong, but bathing in a way where she could be seen. The Gemara says there was a big screen, and the screen blew away, and he saw her. He should have walked away at that point. Right? That's what you should... Whoa, I didn't mean to do that. I'm walking away. Okay, thank you. Right? But when you stick around, and you look, and you go, I'm intrigued. And in the movie, he's eating grapes. And So he's standing by the thing and he keeps looking and he says, go away, you should walk away now. Right? Then it becomes a halach. A halach is a little more difficult to cast out of the house. An oreach. A halach, you could just say, listen, pal, I didn't know you were coming. Goodbye. Right? But on oreach, you invited him in. Okay, now it's time to get up. And we give 5-7 hints that it's time to go. I'm really tired. He says, well, just one more piece of pie. So, all right, so now an oreach or also, he's not sleeping over, but an ish. Anish is like paying rent. He's living in your house already, you know. So this is the situation at hand here, and he's asking Hashem's help. I'm asking you to erase this from your book. Right? That I know it's there. I know I can't change it. I can't go back and maybe I would do things differently now. But I can't change that now, really, with maybe the central pasuk here. It's a song. Lev tahor beroli elokim, ruach nachon chadesh bekirbi. Al tashlichen emilfanecha, ruach kodshecha al tikach mimeni. Right? God, I have a pure soul. Circumstance drove me to this. You think I would have done this if I was king? Excuse me, you think she would have come to you if you weren't king? But, you know, he called for her. She could have said, you know, no. Right? So, I started off with a Lev Tahor. And I started with a Ruach Nachon, an established Ruach. Right? I would like it to make it a Chiddush, God. Help me. Al Tashlechen in Lefanecha. Ruach Kodshachal Tikamen. Now, here is how I go back to where I started the Shir. Is that when we want to know at the end of the Tshuva season, was this a successful Tshuva season? So, halavai, there should be some kind of sign from God. Show me a sign, please. Show me something. Remember that Dave? Remember that story I told you about Dave? That's a crazy story. I just have to say it. this guy Dave was starting to keep Shabbos a few times, but then it wasn't going. It wasn't going for him. So he decided he was going to drop Shabbos. This was finally the one Friday night after he'd already been watching TV. And this is a guy who was like with Eisha Torah and keeping Shabbos for a few months. He said to God, God, please show me one sign. And if you show me a sign, I'll keep Shabbos. Now, why this man was zoche for such a sign, I'll never know. Robin Williams was on the David Letterman show describing a scene from a film that he was filming in Israel. This was years ago. And so David Letterman asked, and it was a Friday night, 11:30, and David Letterman asks him, so what was it like to be in Israel? He goes, there's one thing I cannot forget. Friday afternoon, everybody is saying to each other, good Shabbos, Robin, good Shabbos, everybody, good Shabbos, good Shabbos. So because of that, the audience started screaming out to David Letterman, good Shabbos, Dave, throughout the whole thing. Good Shabbos, Dave. So at one point, right before a commercial, it goes right into David Letterman's big fat face, and the whole audience screams out, good Shabbos, Dave. And this guy saw that was God's sign to him. He's a Rosh Yeshiva now in Asia Torah. I'm not joking. It's a true story.
He turned off the TV.
I think he left it on for the rest of Shabbos. That's a big question. So what? How was he zoche for such a sign? I never got a sign like that. Yes, he did. Kadosh Baruch Hu sent me the most wonderful thing that I ever had in my whole existence. She comes here even to hear this. So, everybody has this, Rabbi, ask yourself, if we open our eyes, we'll see those signs. So here, David is telling him, Ruach Kodeshecha Al Tikach Mimeni, he says, I want to see something. I want to show me some signs. So, say, in the movie, there was a famine, and the famine ended. So David said, okay, now we're back in the saddle, right? But I think the better test of the sign we should be looking for is not a question of what God does for us. That's we shouldn't be thinking in that direction. The direction we should be thinking is, how am I going to act the next time this kind of situation shows up? Right? Chapter 51 is so seminal in the tshuva process, but there's one, I just want to do the beginning of chapter 32 also. Well, the Shana, I don't have 26 and 27, which is also, just read them in English if you can. The 32 begins, L'David Maskil, Ashrei Nesui Pesha Kisui Chata'o. Happy is he whose transgression is forgiven, whose sin is covered over. Is that another cover-up? The Gemara in Maseches Shabbos, which I actually have here for you, on the second page, it says, look just at the second page, it says, Ksiv, even have that Halach Gemara here, Ksiv, Ashrei Nesui Pesha Kisui Chata'a, Uksiv Mechasep Sha'ov Lo Yatzliach. You see at the top of the page there, Yuma Pevov? It says, happy is the one who hides his guilt, and then it says, if you hide your guilt, you will not succeed. Make up your mind. Is it good to hide your guilt or not? The answer is, habachet mefursam, habachet sheina mefursam. Okay. One is where everyone knows about it already. Okay, talk it over. Go to group therapy. One is where no one knows about it. Try to hold on to it. All right, so the Rishonim explained this to be, as we continue, the Gemara to stress, mitzvahs ben adam l'chaveiro and mitzvahs ben adam l'makom. There's no reason for me to share with anyone that in a moment of weakness I had a cheeseburger. Please don't quote that. I'm making an example. Okay. The weakness is, if it's between me and God, I'll keep that between me and God. But if it's between me and another person, it might be better to talk to another person. Maybe not that person yet, but another person, and ask advice. What should I do about this? And people talk this way all the time. Should I go to this person? Does it make sense? I've tried 3 times. It doesn't work. So you're there. You can talk to another person. Right? So there's a lot of group therapy stuff in this chapter 32, but we were sort of very much out of time now. Next week we are called for, I think it's Hosea. We're going to do Hosea next week. Okay, Hosea is something that amazing that happens in Hosea chapter 14. It's the Haftorah of Shabbos Shuvah, and I think I divide Hosea and Yoel. You can look that up, it's on schedule. Yeah, so Hosea. You see it. Hosea is next week.
Yep.
Okay, Hosea, it is. All right. So we'll see some amazing stuff there. Thank you, everyone. Mariv is